Listening to Human Machine, a program which airs each Saturday on WGXC 90.7 FM. Research in various fields examine the speculative next stage in human evolution, in which technological and human architectures will continue their deep convergence. Here we will present weekly works on the horizons of the human machine.
Data center is one of the most challenging issues a data center manager may face. Let's take a look at a common scenario where data center cooling degrades over time, then a best practice solution that can be implemented in stages to keep cooling predictable and the data center manager in control. Our data center manager starts with a 160 kilowatt cooling requirement, averaging 1.5 kilowatts per rack. He arranges the room in a hot, cold aisle configuration with four air conditioning units at the end of the hot aisles for optimal cooling. Within a few months, the data center manager notices that there are some spots in the data center with slightly varying temperatures due to a less than optimal floor tile arrangement. To remedy this, he rearranges the tiles, moving perforated tiles to only the cold aisle and directly in front of the racks. 6 months later, it's time for an IT refresh. Newer, more dense, and more compact equipment is installed. Each device generates nearly the same heat as the old equipment. However, the racks now hold more equipment, so the overall amount of heat produced increases. This creates localized hotspots around the data center. This also changes the airflow of the room by stealing air from neighboring racks with lower densities. To counter this, the data center manager redistributes the newer, denser equipment across several racks. 6 months later, and it's time for another IT refresh. Even more equipment is added, leading to higher power densities as well as cable congestion from additional network drops and power cords. Air recirculation increases. Because the new, denser servers cannot draw the necessary airflow from the raised flooring for proper cooling, they must pull the required air from another source. The air temperature across the entire room also begins to rise. As more heat is generated, the curtain of hot air at the top of the room is lowered closer to the rack inlet. The cooling situation in the data center becomes critical. Over the next year, the data center manager makes several attempts to correct it. The first thing he tries to do is add cooling capacity. Unfortunately, while this adds cooling capacity, it does not fix the problem, which is one of air distribution. The increased cooling capacity in the room lowers the return temperature to the cracks, resulting in an overall reduction in capacity from the cracks. The data center manager then tries to make the room colder by lowering the set point. This too does not address the problem of air distribution. In fact, lowering the set point actually decreases the cooling capacity further. Air conditioning units work most efficiently when receiving higher return air temperatures. The data center manager tries to deal with the problem by replacing the tiles. To make perforated holes larger, he changes out some of the standard floor tiles with 56% free perforated tiles. This causes a drop in air pressure and non-uniform airflow that, in turn, creates unpredictable airflow patterns. Even more hotspots form due to the reduction of airflow in some areas. The data center manager tries plugging up cable access holes with brush strips. Unfortunately, this only has a slight impact on the problem. It is now 2 years after the initial data center installation. The data center manager begins to implement, in stages, a best practice solution. He reconfigures two of the four rows in the data center for in-row cooling. Four legacy crack units are removed and three network air IR units are installed. In-row cooling not only shortens the path between the hot air and the heat removal device, it also removes from the cooling equation the unpredictable nature of cold air delivery. Now there are 7 air conditioning units instead of 8, 20% more cooling capacity in the converted rows, and less humidification required. During the second stage of implementation, the data center manager repeats this same step for the remaining 2 rows. This net result is 6 air conditioning units instead of 8, 20% more cooling capacity per row, and a predictable cooling architecture. The final step in this best practice solution is the addition of a hot aisle containment system for areas of the data center supporting high-density applications. Sealing the hot aisle off from the rest of the room ensures that the hot air will not mix with the supply air. Now the cluster of high-density racks can be environmentally controlled separately. This decreases the amount of energy the system uses and allows the cooling system to be run at its full capacity. While effectively cooling high-density environments is challenging, APC can help you increase data center availability and decrease your total cost of ownership through proper cooling methodologies. Infrastructure architecture is a standardized, open building block approach that keeps data center cooling predictable and the data center manager in control in both new and existing data centers.
APC's Hot Aisle Containment System, or HACS, consists of doors that cap both ends of the row. Transparent ceiling tiles, and APC's own in-row cooling units with variable speed fans, and a temperature-controlled air supply to the cold aisle. The hot aisle containment system isolates the hot aisle from the rest of the room, enabling the in-row cooling units to capture all the heat from the IT equipment, neutralize it, and supply cold air to the cold aisle. Cold aisle containment, or CAC, is typically deployed as an improvement to environments with traditional room cooling in place. The cold aisle containment system isolates cold air in the aisle, drawing hot air from the data center space. Both the hot aisle and cold aisle containment systems eliminate the mixing of hot and cold air. By keeping these airstreams separate, the cooling system can run with more predictability and efficiency. While both the hot aisle and cold aisle systems help solve today's data center challenges, the cold aisle containment exhibits some limitations in comparison with the hot aisle system. With the hot air contained, the in-row cooling units are able to capture all of the heat from the IT equipment. Mixing from the room is also eliminated, which increases the return temperature, increasing cooling capacity and efficiency of the in-row cooling units. With mixing eliminated, the in-row cooling system's variable speed is minimized, further reducing energy consumption. The cold aisle containment system is designed to isolate the cold aisle and allow the room temperature to increase, which in turn increases the return air temperature to the room cooling units. Because of floor leakage and other mixing that happens within a room cooling environment, the return air temperature cannot reach the same temperatures as in the HACS, resulting in less efficient operation of the cooling system. To improve efficiency in cold aisle containment, the temperature of the room must increase. This poses an issue for any equipment in the data center that is not contained, leaving non-rack equipment operating well above recommended temperatures. The hot aisle containment system can easily be dropped in to any data center without impacting the data center environment.
Typical raised floor systems only deliver enough cold air to support a maximum of 6 to 8 kilowatts per rack. Higher densities require specialized design or the addition of fan devices for proper airflow. APC's in-row cooling solution in the hot aisle containment system supports densities of 30 kilowatts per rack and beyond. A significant advantage that the hot aisle system has over the cold aisle system is the ability to extend runtime. In the event of a cooling failure, runtime is decreased with CACS because the cold air used to cool the IT equipment is drawn only from the center aisle. In HACS, the equipment will draw the cold air from the entire data center, resulting in fewer cooling failures and extended runtimes.
How to model different types of cooling. Let's look at different data center cooling models. This room has traditional downflow cooling. In it, large cooling units send cold air under a raised floor. The cold air then comes out through perforated floor tiles. Let's add more perforated tiles. Capture index and temperature are recalculated immediately. We can also turn on more detail to see under the raised floor. I'm enabling additional overlays specific for downflow cooling. Floor plenum overlay calculates speed and volume of air movement. This is the air pressure in the plenum. Now, let's look at this room in 3D view. We can see perforated tiles and raised floor plenum. Let's calculate the temperature map. The temperature map is calculated on client computer. Once it's calculated, I can position the cooling plane anywhere in the room. I can also look at the velocity plane. I can see how the air comes out of the perforated tiles and how it's sucked into coolers. I can center the view on a particular piece of equipment. Now, the view will rotate around this item. Note that the 3D calculations are based on the nameplate values. And that's how you model downflow cooling. Now, let's look at in-row cooling. In this room, cooling units are positioned in the rows. I can get load and temperature values for the cooling units. For each rack, I can get the temperature and capture index. I can also simulate the switching off of a cooling unit and then see the results immediately. Let's look at this room in 3D. This cooling type does not require a raised floor. Also, it's quicker to calculate a temperature map for this model. The walkway seems to be rather hot, but the rows are properly cooled. This room looks very empty. I can add some room fixtures to add as a navigation aid. I can add a door to the room and a window. I can also define the size and position of these fixtures. The doors and windows will appear in the 3D view, but they do not affect the calculations. They are presumed to be fully insulated. And that's how you model in-row cooling. Now let's take a look at another cooling model, over-aisle cooling. In this room, cooling units are placed above the hot aisles. To capture the hot air expelled by the equipment below, this model requires a hot aisle containment system. You then need to drag overhead coolers on top. The containment system keeps hot air away from the rest of the room. Now, let's look at this in 3D. We presume that hacks have a room between the coolers. It takes longer to calculate this model's temperature map. But the entire room outside the hacks should have the same temperature. Let's change the temperature scale. Now I can see some hot air inside hacks. The doors are presumed to be well insulated. We can see more hot air spots. Let's look at the velocity plane. Here, the colors represent air velocity, not temperature. I can see how air is expelled by coolers and sucked back by the racks. The last model is EcoBreeze Cooling. In this example, there are no coolers in the room. They're placed outside the building. We modeled this by placing ventilation grills on the walls. They move air in and out of the room. In and out airflow must be balanced. For this reason, I'll add another grill with air coming into the room. It's positioned just above the floor. Let's look at it in 3D. Air is expelled through grills above the drop ceiling. In this way, cold air is brought into the cold aisle. Let's calculate the temperature map. I can see hot air rising to the ceiling. You can change the temperature map colors. For example, you can use more traditional InfraCam colors. Now, let's look at the velocity plane. I can see air flowing into the room. The air eventually diffuses through the drop ceiling. And that's how you model different types of cooling.
Your first key challenge is risk management, which can be addressed with a layered physical security approach. Risks are inherent in data centers, not just from cyber criminals or those with malicious intent, but also from third-party contractors and employees who may have access to inflict unintended or intended damage. Deploying a layered security strategy can provide you with the ability to deter, detect, or detain at every layer of your data center's security, reducing the risk of breach and increasing your peace of mind. The site perimeter is not just a border, it is the first layer of data center protection. Measures used to fortify perimeter security include video surveillance of the property perimeter, limited entry points with access control, physical security barriers such as reinforced walls or anti-ram fencing and gates, and guard stations for security personnel. These are all designed to deter intruders. Car traps and security personnel can delay intruders. The second layer of security addresses the space between the perimeter and the building exterior. This area is monitored by intrusion detection sensors and video surveillance to identify breaches. The third layer is the highest level of perimeter security, where you have the opportunity to prevent unauthorized access into the facility. The fourth layer of security validates access rights of authorized individuals into specific environments, such as your data hall, network operations center, entrance rooms, power and cooling facility areas. As you enter the data hall, the fifth layer of security is the selective profile of authorized staff, contractors, and visitors to ensure access is limited and approved for this critical space. The sixth level of security provides controlled access and accountability directly at the equipment location. The interoperability of these six layers mitigates your risk, offering effective and efficient protection of your facility's critical data. The selection and sizing of the appropriate physical security list of materials can be quite challenging. Best-in-class technologies and the interoperability of components and subsystems are key considerations. Various stakeholders have different but equally important data center security concerns. Annexstar will help you consider the individual needs of each department to meet the collective challenge of managing risk. In addition to data center security, Annexstar's infrastructure as a platform not only addresses key technology areas, it also helps you meet the challenges of project deployment, facility assessment, and controlled repeatability in your data center environment.
Securing a physical environment requires an integrated approach towards detection and distribution of information. It transforms the video surveillance system into a true physical security information management platform in a wide range of industries and sectors, municipalities and government agencies, transportation, corporate, retail, industrial, education, and more. It incorporates IP video from an unlimited number of cameras connected to multiple recording servers at multiple sites with best-of-breed physical security and video intelligence systems. Incidents and alerts are received from access control systems, video content analytics, emergency call boxes, contact closure devices, transaction systems, license plate readers, radiation and hazardous materials detectors, audio detectors, and other physical security and data systems. The following demonstrates the handling of a real-life security breach in a campus environment, going through the process of event detection, automated video alerting, investigation, distribution of video to users, and generation of evidence. An integrated access control system manages the entry of all persons into the secured facility. All card swipe information is sent to Ocularis and registered as an event which can later be retrieved. The entry point is also monitored by an IP video camera connected to an ONSSI or other company video recorder. Video content analytics analyze the entrance movement patterns to detect tailgating, two persons entering with one card swipe, which could not have been detected by the access control system alone. Through the process of event fusion, a single swipe event received from an access control system is combined with a tailgating event from a video content analytics system. The result is a composite illegal entry event. The entry point has been breached. The security of the facility has been compromised. Upon generating the event, a push live video alert automatically pops up on the facility security officer's monitor. Using blank screen monitoring, view panes in the Ocularis client are configured to remain blank until they are populated by video alerts. By receiving automatic alerts of incidents, fewer operators are required for monitoring large camera arrays. The security officer maximizes the video to full screen, and if needed, synchronously reviews the recording to trace the perpetrator's steps through synchronous recorded camera views. Using the Ocularis client map-based navigation interface, the officer instantly navigates and drills down to the building where the incident had taken place, and by simple drag and drop, brings up an entire camera group onto his monitor. Determining which camera best covers the break-in, he proceeds to send a manual push video to the local police, enables manual push video alerting to multiple locations. With one click, the security officer pushes a live video alert to the police precinct. A drop-down menu conveniently lists EMS, law enforcement, and other recipients on the network. Live video instantly pops up on the police precinct video wall, as well as the police officer's Ocularis client screen. The officer brings the alert to full screen. For quick access to the exact time of entry, the officer swipes the kinetic timeline to review extended periods of time. Synchronous playback of multiple cameras enable the tracing of the suspect's steps from one room to another, never losing sight of his exact location. Multiple operators at different locations can simultaneously access and handle events detected across the entire system through the shared event management panel. Clicking on the dynamically updated alerts list will present the recorded event as well as a live stream from the same camera for continued monitoring and investigation. The exact location of the incident is clearly indicated on the navigation map, with easy access to surrounding cameras. Handled events are stored along with all event information and operators' comments. At the same time, on another Ocularis client screen, a fellow officer uses the Ocularis client time slicer and motion slicer tools to find when the perpetrator has parked his vehicle. Within seconds, using increasingly smaller intervals, the vehicle is found. Once the suspect is found, the officer enhances the image using digital PTZ, simply by drawing a square across the screen. The perpetrator is identified. The control room police officer then pushes a live video alert to a police cruiser mounted mobile data terminal, or MDT. The officer in the vehicle is able to view live video as well as recorded video to determine the current location of the suspect. Exiting the police cruiser, the officer connects to the video system via PDA or smartphone. Using ONSSI's NetPDA and NetCell handheld video applications. This allows for around-the-corner monitoring of the incident and provides real-time information while keeping the officer at a safe distance. With a positive ID and the perpetrator's current location, the perpetrator is reached and placed under arrest. Back at the local police headquarters, segments of video from single or multiple cameras are bookmarked, building a case file for the incident. Using a simple graphical interface, bookmarks are highlighted and annotated with event information and operators' comments. Once entered, bookmarks are stored in a database on a server and can be easily retrieved for further investigation. For court purposes, a multi-camera digitally watermarked video database can be exported, assuring the authenticity of the video data. Or, if needed, evidence is exported to an AVI file or a still image incident report. It represents a quantum leap in intelligent IP video management, providing the intelligence, investigation tools, and most user-friendly client interface. It enables the detection, shared management, investigation, and generation of evidence of events, all within seconds.
I've worked with the instructional designers here in the College of Justice and Safety to develop an augmented reality model. Now, augmented reality was designed to produce and provide a view of a physical, real-world type environment whose elements are augmented by computer-generated sensory input. And to boil that down, the purpose of this model is to give you, the student, a better idea of what to look for when you're conducting a security site survey. For purposes of today's demonstration, this model is going to be the first floor in the grounds of a small community hospital. Remember, this is just an example. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to assessments at a critical infrastructure site. We're going to provide several points of consideration to contemplate when conducting your own assessment. Let's go ahead and get started. Now, as we've discussed in this course, there's 18 critical infrastructure sectors in the United States. One of those sectors is the healthcare and public health sector. This sector is going to account for approximately 15% of the gross national product, and more importantly, it plays a significant role in response and recovery across all the other sectors. The goal of this sector is to mount a timely and effective response to both routine and emergency situations as it strives to protect the critical workforce in this country from harm. Before even arriving on site at the hospital depicted in this model, remember that I'm going to conduct some background investigation with the hospital personnel, local law enforcement, and other data acquisition methods to determine the crime rate in the area, if there's any problems in the area with issues such as vandalism or anything in that manner. Lastly, I'm going to request from the hospital any standard operating procedures, especially if those items deal with safety and security related items. Now that we've conducted some of our background research, let's take a look in front of me here, and we're going to the facility, and this is our augmented reality model. Okay, let's start by looking at the outward perimeter. As you're going to see, all around the facility on three of the sides, we're going to have a fence line of trees and shrubs. Basically, this is setting the perimeter for our facility. This, as we've talked about in previous chapters, could be defined as crime prevention through environmental design. What we're looking at is a way to offset the hospital's property from other properties that may flank on each side. So that's one of the parts. Given that it's a hospital, most hospitals don't have a requirement for fencing or other types of hardware, so this is not necessarily a concern of ours for this facility. Next, we're working our way in. As you can tell, on two sides of this facility, you're going to have parking lots. These parking lots have cars parked in them. They could be either staff, doctors of the facility, or they might be visitors to the facility. If you look closely, these parking lots also have security lighting in them. So as we've talked about in the lighting chapter, one of the things we're going to look for with security lighting is we're going to come back after dark, and we're going to bring our security light meter with us, and we're going to determine what the illuminance of that area is. We'll consult that in either lux or foot candles, whatever your preference may be, and determine if the lighting requirements for these parking lots are sufficient for this area. So that's another thing we're going to look at here before we even get into the building. Now, one of the other things we'll look at, we'll go here to the front of the building, and we'll see that where the ambulance is parked there, we've got a public road that runs right in front of this building, okay? It's going to be one that provides easy access to the hospital there. So we want to take a look at how we're accessing this. The front of the building here has two entrances, as you can see right there. Those two, one of them is the main entrance to the hospital, and the one right in front of the ambulance there is the emergency room. Now, we've talked in this class about the easiest way to design security is at the blueprint phase, but the reality is going to be that we may not always have that opportunity. So what we want to do is do the best we can with what we have in front of us. One of the things that's missing here that we need to take a look at is we need to have some barriers. And this will keep a car or other vehicle from coming in those front doors, whether on purpose or accidentally or either way. So something like a bollard or some other type of barrier on those front doors. The best way, if the hospital was going to do a redesign at some point, would be that they would reevaluate their entrance and maybe put the emergency room main doors on this side of the hospital, keeping it away from the main entrance of the hospital, okay? So then we'll come back around. We want to look at the perimeter of this building. Now we're getting into the actual facility itself. What you're going to see here is that outside view again. Again, two doors. The one with the emergency obviously is marked the emergency room department. You're going to see the main set of doors. Now, it may be a little bit counterintuitive for a security professional to take a look at the locks on a hospital, because we assume that hospitals are open access and that they should be able to be accessed at all times. However, keep in mind that after hours, we may lock the main entrance door seen right there, and we may divert folks to the emergency room doors. Also keep in mind, if there's a security threat inside that hospital, anywhere inside of this hospital, we may have to go into a security lockdown whereby we'll lock all the doors of this hospital. So we want to take a look at the locks and make sure that they are that they can secure this building appropriately. We also want to take a look at the doors. Remember, you can have a great effective lock, but if the doors are not effective, then the locks are worth nothing, okay? So make sure that the assembly hinges and pieces such as that are not exposed, and that they can secure the facility and the people and the assets within. All right, let's move our way through the front door. And what we're gonna see here is inside, right there when we come in, is gonna be the welcome center, information center, waiting room area, okay? And what we want to look at this is where an individual is going to sit, and they will inform people where to go, what patient, what room the patient's in, and so forth and so on. There will be a group of seats, as you can see, around that for folks to wait for people to come out of surgery, for them to wait for visiting hours and other activities inside the hospital. You'll see a vending area right there next to the welcome center. This area can be used for different concessions and for hotel patrons to use while they're there. Now, with the vending area, we won't have active people in there selling goods, but we will have machines. So if necessary, maybe a small surveillance camera can be installed to make sure the machines are not vandalized after hours or anything doesn't happen like that to that area. On the other side of that concessions area, you're going to find a small gift shop. very customary to a hospital. A gift shop provides things like flowers and balloons and other small gifts to take up to the patients to brighten their day. Obviously, we'll have a staff person working in that gift shop, and we're going to have a cash management piece to that. We want to make sure that that's secure in some type of lockable register and make sure that policies and procedures have been put into place so that cash can be transferred to a safe at the end of the night. It also probably be a good idea to put some type of surveillance in there, at least to try to defend against shoplifting or other types of crimes that may occur. All right, we're going to move over here to this side of the building. Right here in this corner, you're going to see a desk, and that desk is the business center of the hospital. This is where you'll come to pay your bills. This is where they'll assess where you need to go in terms of outpatient surgeries. This is where the control of all financial matters will happen within the hospital. Without an effective billing and collections piece of the hospital cannot operate appropriately, so it's a very necessary piece. There are data security issues here. We have laws with the HIPAA laws and different healthcare privacy acts now that we have to be considerate of when dealing with patient information. So we have to make sure that that computer has a security lockdown procedures on it, that has the effective software so that that information cannot be accessed. We're going to move in now closer and look at the security office right there on the other side of that. You'll see a whole host of monitors inside of there. This is where a security guard could sit. This is where all the cameras inside of the hospital are monitored or at least recorded. Quite likely, the security force in this small hospital will be somewhat limited. The security guard will probably not man this post at all times, so we want to make sure that there is adequate recording capabilities at this time. The two offices on each side of that security office are both business offices. This could be filing, this could be storage of records, this could be different parts and pieces of running the business of a hospital. Office security templates should be used here, the security checklist that we've talked about. They do the same with computer security to ensure that those are effective. Now, moving to the very middle, you'll see that yellowish box right there as we go. That signifies our elevator shaft. There are several ways to lock down an elevator shaft. In terms of looking at it like this, you're going to be able to see that there's two different elevator shafts. This comes into play a lot when we deal with floors such as labor and delivery or other floors where assets, we want to make sure that assets aren't taken away. For example, in the labor delivery floor, we might want to install some RFID technology, radio frequency identification, attach that to the hospital armbands to make sure that those newborn babies don't walk off without their parents in tow. Okay, now we're going to turn now to this back corner of the hospital, right back in here, and we're going to see a suite of different patient rooms. Now, these rooms may be used for outpatient surgery type rooms. They could be used for different procedures. They could even be used for patient rooms. What you're going to see is a door right there that comes in and makes sure that no one gets access to that area. It's not a public access area. So on that door, we'd be anticipating some type of access control system, whether that be a biometric or some type of card reader system of some type to make sure that folks don't get into that area if they don't belong. You're going to see a nurse's station or a check-in desk there, as right there when you get inside that door. That will keep some folks from accessing that area, but you can't rely on a human manning a post at all times. You want to make sure that the effective access control systems are in place. Now, one of these rooms, as you rotate around, you're going to see a whole host of different pharmacy-type cabinets in there. If you look at the very top of the screen there. And what the purpose of this room is will be some type of drug or pharmaceutical storage area. This obviously is a security risk to this hospital. The obtainment of drugs, either in a legal format or legally, and then selling them to others is a huge problem in the United States. We want to try to counteract that with the appropriate controls on that room. Obviously, surveillance cameras would be a good idea for that room. We'd also want to make sure the appropriate access controls are also inside that room. We also want to make sure as we go around the side, we can see there's no windows on this side. That's a good idea from a security concern, so that's one less security feature that we're going to have to install. We won't have to worry about window breaks or any volumetric type devices on those windows. We can just go ahead and concentrate on the interior door and have folks where they're accessing that. All right. The remainder of this time I want to spend on this other part of the hospital here in the back corner. What you're going to see is this is our emergency room. So I'm going to turn us around and I'm going to have us come in those front doors right here into the emergency department. What you're going to see when you come in right here in the corner is a kind of a welcome type desk. This would be where a receptionist or some type of entry would check you into the emergency room. Some waiting areas, as if you've visited a waiting room in any hospital, you'll know that there is going to be some waiting involved. So we'll have some of that. What you're going to see right across from it, right up here, is a triage area, a couple different triage rooms. As you know, in an emergency room department, the ideal is you come in, you're checked in, and then a nurse or nurse practitioner of some type triages your situation to determine the severity of your need, whether they need to take you back right then, or whether you can wait and let more severe patients take precedence over you. You're going to see a couple other treatment rooms. These could be suture rooms or other types of specialty rooms, maybe with different types of equipment, with EKG machines or other types of equipment. So the entire piece, we've got access controls placed on these rooms in a secure area to make sure the patient records are kept intact and that the different equipment is also kept intact. I'm going to take you to the back of the hospital now, this back corner. We've got a suite of four different patient working rooms where they can receive emergency treatment. This can range in severity from a community hospital where they're just trying to stabilize individuals to get them ready for processing to a larger hospital. Or this could be a simple stitch or two or some different type of procedure that they're going to take care of. We want to try to maintain as much privacy in these rooms as possible while making sure that the safety and security of our hospital staff and visitors is maintained. Basically, we have a holistic approach here on this first floor of this hospital. You might be thinking to yourself, now this doesn't look like the hospital that I go to. I want you to remember, as I stated at the beginning, there's no one size fits all. Every facility, every building is going to be a little bit different. When we get into assessing critical infrastructure and assessing security, there's no one size fits all approach to that.
In Austria, technicians check the welding on pipes for a hydropower plant. Over in Indonesia, spices are being cleared of biological contaminants. In Budapest, pharmaceuticals are being created. And operators run a Chinese power plant that provides electricity to thousands of homes. These are common activities, taking place every day in many parts of the world. They rely on nuclear technologies that use radioactive materials. The benefits of these technologies, whether used in agriculture, industry, or medicine, are plentiful. Like other processes, they generate waste. This waste contains radioactive elements. People and the environment must be protected from the potential hazards of such waste, now and in the future. So countries need to manage their radioactive waste safely and securely, and make sure it's kept under control. This responsibility starts as soon as a country decides to use nuclear technologies. and techniques are available to manage radioactive waste. Radioactive elements are unstable and emit radiation as they decay. The decay rate is measured in half lives. This means the time it takes for the activity of a radionuclide to halve. After another half-life period, the activity is again down by half. This continues, and eventually the material emits only negligible amounts of ionizing radiation. Each radionuclide has its own half-life. So waste can be hazardous for periods of time stretching from a few hours or days up to hundreds of thousands of years. Radioactive waste is classified depending on the half-lives and the level of radioactivity of the nuclides it contains. According to the IAEA's safety standards, there are six classes of radioactive waste. Each waste class has different management and disposal needs. Techniques exist to manage this radioactive waste and the spent nuclear fuel from power plants and research reactors in a safe and secure way. Waste containing only radionuclides with very short half-lives can be stored for a few days or years to allow for the decay of the nuclides. This type of waste is usually generated when radioactive materials are used for research or medical purposes. Eventually, it can be disposed of as conventional waste. Other waste forms need to be managed for radioactive waste disposal. By volume, most radioactive waste has low levels of radioactivity. This includes the majority of the waste that comes from the routine operation of a nuclear power plant. And waste that's produced when medical and industrial devices that use radioactive sources are no longer needed. This could be because the source has decayed and the remaining radioactivity isn't strong enough for its original purpose. Or the device is damaged or obsolete. In these cases, the radioactive source needs to be removed from the equipment and prepared for storage and eventual disposal. Some countries process their waste at centralized waste management and storage facilities. Upon arrival, the waste is controlled to check for any surface contamination, and the radiation levels are measured. Details of the waste type are noted for the inventory before the waste can be processed further to prepare it for storage and disposal. Such processes can involve measures to reduce the volume of the waste, such as compaction and incineration. Encapsulation is used to immobilize the contaminants. After being placed in appropriate containers, the waste is stored. It will remain in this kind of facility until a suitable place or system for its disposal is established. Many countries already have near-surface disposal sites for waste with low levels of radioactivity. These facilities can consist of silos in the ground, trenches, or vaults. Once they're full, they will be backfilled with grout or soil, sealed and closed according to their disposal license. Alongside the radioactive waste produced by the routine activities at a nuclear power plant, nuclear power generation produces spent fuel or high-level waste. Such waste is low in volume, but has a high level of radioactivity, and it remains hazardous for thousands of years. In some countries, the spent nuclear fuel that can no longer be used to generate electricity is reprocessed to extract usable material for new fuel. Other countries consider the spent fuel as waste for direct disposal. In all countries generating nuclear power, the spent fuel is currently stored either in water pools or dry casks at secure storage facilities. Waste management experts around the world agree that underground geological disposal is the best and preferred option as a solution for high-level waste and spent nuclear fuel. This would be in a location where geological conditions are stable and the waste can be contained and isolated from humans and the environment until it no longer presents a hazard. While there's still no geological disposal facility of this type in operation, some countries have already selected a location, designed the facility, and conducted safety assessments.
Tape has brightening arm connect. Self-paint lever itchy does. Shaving copter anymore. Well-crat tonsils beep in act. What does it mean? What does it mean? I put it in my thinking machine. Uncle 14 marching flame. Sleep expensive, cloud enjoy. Gerblong tromflung dim fim limb. Dog, 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 dog. What does it mean? What does it mean? I put it in my thinking machine. Cash fog Ansel Adams mouth. Green grape gravy, grateful crab. Skele-tele-teleton. The word for word is word. What does it mean? What does it mean?
Listening to the program Human Machine on WGXC. Listen on Saturday mornings to subsequent episodes where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human machine evolution.